to heal. And with this cold, and we have such a long way to ride. Erland got some salve and cloths from the tenant farmer and carefully tended to the other man's wounds. Simon had two flesh wounds right next to each other on the left side of his chest. They bled a great deal at first, but they weren't serious. Erland had been slashed on the thigh by Björn's spear. That would make it painful to ride, said Simon. But his brother-in-law laughed. It had barely made a scratch through his leather hose. He dabbed at it a bit, and then wrapped it tightly against the frost. It was bitterly cold. Before they reached the bottom of the hill on which the farm stood, their horses were covered with rime, and the fur trim on the men's hoods had turned white.
Brr, Erland shivered. If only we were home. We'll have to ride over to the manor down here and report the slaying.
Is that necessary? Asked Simon. I spoke to Vidar and the others after all.
It would be better if you did so, said Erland. You should report the news yourself. Don't let them have anything to hold against you.
The sun had slipped behind the ridge now. The evening was a pale grayish blue, but still light. They rode along a creek, beneath the branches of birch trees that were even more shaggy with frost than the rest of the forest. There was a stink of raw, icy fog in the air, which could make a man's breath stick in his throat. Erland grumbled impatiently about the long period of cold they had had, and about the chill ride that lay before them.
You're not getting frostbite on your face, are you, brother-in-law?
He peered anxiously under Simon's hood. Simon rubbed his hand over his face. It wasn't frostbitten, but he had grown quite pale as he rode. It didn't suit him, because his large, portly face was weather-beaten and ruddy, and the paleness appeared in gray blotches, which made his complexion look unclean.
Have you ever seen a man spreading manure with his sword the way Ulf did? Asked Erland.
He burst out laughing at the memory and leaned forward in his saddle to imitate the gesture.
What a splendid envoy he is. You should have seen Ulf playing with his sword, Simon. Jesus Maria.
Playing? Well, now he'd seen Erland Nikolausen playing at that game. Over and over again he saw himself and the other men tumbling around the hearth, the way farmers chop wood or toss hay. And Erland's slender, lightning-swift figure among them, his gaze alert and his wrist steady as he danced with them, quick-witted and an expert swordsman. More than 20 years ago, he himself had been considered one of the foremost swordsmen among the youth of the royal retainers, when they practiced out on the green. But since then, he hadn't had much opportunity to use his knightly skills. And here he was now, riding along and feeling sick at heart because he had killed a man. He kept seeing Holmgeir's body as it fell from his sword and sank into the fire. He heard the man's abrupt, strangled death cry in his ears and saw again and again images of the brief, furious battle that followed. He felt dejected, pained, and confused. They had turned on him suddenly, all those men with whom he had sat and felt a sense of belonging. And then Erland had come to his aid. He had never thought himself a coward. He had hunted down 6 bears during the years he had lived at Formo, and twice he had put his life at risk in the most reckless manner. With only the thin trunk of a pine tree between him and a raging wounded female, with no other weapon than his spear point on a shaft a scant hand's breadth long, the tenseness of the game had not disturbed his steadiness of thought, action, or instinct. But now, in that outbuilding, he didn't know if he had been afraid, but he certainly had been confused, unable to think clearly. When he was back home after the bear hunt, with his clothes thrown on haphazardly, with his arm in a sling, feverish, his shoulder stiff and torn, he had merely felt an overwhelming joy. Things might have gone worse, how much worse, he didn't dwell on. But now he kept thinking about it ceaselessly, how everything might have ended if Erland hadn't come to his aid just in time. He hadn't been afraid, but he had such a peculiar feeling. It was the expressions on the faces of the other men,
and Holmgar's dying body. He had never killed a man before. Except for the Swedish horseman he had felled. It was during the year when King Håkon led an incursion into Sweden to avenge the murder of the dukes. Simon had been sent out on a scouting mission. He had taken along three men, and he was to be their chieftain. How bold and cocky he was. Simon remembered that his sword had gotten stuck in the steel helmet of the horseman, so that he had to pry and wriggle it loose. There was a nick in the blade when he looked at it the next morning. He had always thought about that incident with pride, and there had been 8 Swedes. He had gotten a taste of war at any rate, and that wasn't the lot of everyone who joined the king's men that year. When daylight came, he saw that blood and brains had splattered over his coat of mail. He tried to look modest and not boastful as he washed it off. But it did no good to think about that poor devil of a horseman now. No, that was not the same thing. He couldn't get rid of a terrible feeling of remorse about Holmgar Moiseson. There was also the fact that he owed Erland his life. He didn't yet know what import this would have, but he felt as if everything would be different, now that he and Erland were even. In that way they were even, at least. The brothers-in-law had been riding in near silence. Once Erland said, "It was foolish of you, Simon, not to think of getting out right from the start." "Why is that?" asked Simon rather brusquely. "Because you were outside?"
"No."
There was the hint of a smile in Erland's voice.
"Well, because of that, too. I hadn't thought about that. But through that narrow door, they couldn't follow you more than one at a time. And it's always astounding how quickly people regain their senses when they come out under the open sky. It seems to me a miracle that there weren't more deaths."
A few times Erland inquired about his brother-in-law's wounds. Simon said he hardly noticed them, even though they were throbbing terribly. They reached Formo late that evening, and Erland went inside with his brother-in-law. He had advised Simon to send the sheriff a report of the incident the very next day in order to arrange for a letter of reprieve as soon as possible. Erland would gladly compose the letter for Simon that night, since the wounds on his chest would no doubt hamper his writing hand.
"And tomorrow you must keep to your bed. You may have a little wound fever."
Romborg and Arnyard were waiting up for them. Because of the cold, they had settled on the bench on the warm side of the hearth, tucking their legs underneath them. A board game lay between them. They looked like a couple of children. Simon had barely uttered a few words about what had happened before his young wife flew to his side and threw her arms around his neck. She pulled his face down to hers and pressed her cheek against his, and she crushed Erland's hand so tightly that he laughingly said he had never thought Rombor could have such strong fingers. She begged her husband to spend the night in the main house so that she could keep watch over him. She implored him, almost in tears, until Erland offered to stay and sleep with Simon if she would send a man north to Jurengard to take word. It was too late for him to ride home anyway,
and a shame for Kristen to sit up so late in this cold. "She waits up for me, too. You're both good wives, you daughters of Lavrans."
While the men ate and drank, Romborg sat close to her husband. Simon patted her arm and hand. He was both a little embarrassed and greatly touched that she showed so much concern and love for him. Simon was sleeping in the Simond house during Lent, and when the men went over there, Romborg went with them and put a large kettle of honey ale to warm near the hearthstone. The Simond house was an ancient little hearth building, warm and snug. The timbers were so roughly hewn that there were only 4 beams to each wall. Right now it was cold, but Simon threw a great armful of resinous pine into the fire and chased his dog up into the bed. The animal could lie there and warm it up for them. They pulled the log chair and the high-backed bench all the way up to the hearth and made themselves comfortable, for they were frozen to the bone after their ride, and the meal in the main house had only partially thawed them. Erland wrote the letter for Simon. Then they proceeded to undress.
Simon's wound began to bleed again when he moved his arms too much, so his brother-in-law helped him pull the outer tunic over his head and take off his boots. Erland limped a bit from his wounded leg. It was stiff and tender after the ride, he said, but it was nothing. Then they sat down near the fire again, half-dressed. The room had grown pleasantly warm, and there was still plenty of ale in the kettle.
I can see that you're taking this much too hard, Erland said once.
They had been dozing and staring into the fire.
He was no great loss to the world, that Holmgar. That's not what Sirrah Moises will think, said Simon quietly.
He's an old man and a good priest. Erland nodded somberly.
It's a bad thing to have made enemies with such a man, especially since he lives so near. And you know that I often have business in that parish.
Yes, well, this kind of thing can happen so easily, to any of us.
They'll probably sentence you to a fine of 10 or 12 marks of gold. And you know that Bishop Hallvard is a stern master when he has to hear the confession of an assailant, and the boy's father is one of his priests. But you'll get through whatever is required.
Simon did not reply. Erland continued.
No doubt I'll have to pay fines for the injuries.
He smiled to himself.
And I own no other piece of Norwegian land than the farm at Dovre.
How big of a farm is Haugen? Asked Simon.
I don't remember exactly. It says in the deed. But the people who work the land harvest only a small amount of hay. No one wants to live there. I've heard that the buildings are in great disrepair. You know what people say. That the dead spirits of my aunt and Herr Bjorn haunt the place. But I know that I will win thanks from my wife for what I did today. Kristen is fond of you, Simon, as if you were her own brother.
Simon's smile was almost imperceptible as he sat there in the shadows. He had pushed the log chair back a bit and had put his hand up to shield his eyes from the heat of the flames. But Erland was as happy as a cat in the heat. He sat close to the hearth, leaning against a corner of the bench, with one arm resting along its back and his wounded leg propped up on the opposite side.
Yes, she had such charming words to say about it one day this past fall, said Simon after a moment.
There was an almost mocking ring to his voice.
When our son was ill, she showed that she was a loyal sister, he said somberly. But then that slightly jesting tone was back. Well, Erlan, we have kept faith with each other the way we swore to do when we gave our hands to Lavrans and vowed to stand by each other as brothers.
Yes, said Erlan, unsuspecting.
I'm glad for what I did today too, Simon, my brother-in-law.
They both fell silent for a while. Then Erland hesitantly stretched out his hand to the other man. Simon took it. They clasped each other's fingers tightly, then let go and huddled back in their seats, a little embarrassed. Finally Erland broke the silence. For a long time he had been sitting with his chin in his hand, staring into the hearth, where only a tiny flame now flickered, flaring up, dancing a bit, and playing over the charred pieces of wood, which broke apart and collapsed with brittle little sighs. Soon there would be only black coals and glowing embers left of the fire. Erland said quite softly,
You have treated me so magnanimously, Simondar, that I think few men are your equal. I haven't forgotten.
Silence.
You don't know, Erland. Only God in heaven knows everything that resides in a man's mind, whispered Simon, frightened and distraught.
That's true, said Erland in the same quiet and somber tone of voice.
We all need him to judge us, with mercy. But a man must judge a man by what he does. And I, may God reward you, brother-in-law.
Then they sat in dead silence, not daring to move for fear of being shamed. Suddenly Erland let his hand fall to his knee. A fiery blue ray of light flashed from the stone on the ring he wore on his right index finger.
Simon knew that Kristin had given it to Erland when he was released from the prison tower.
But you must remember, Simon, he said in a low voice, the old saying. Many a man is given what was intended for another, but no one is given another man's fate.
Simon raised his head sharply. Slowly his face flushed blood red. The veins at his temples stood out like dark, twisted cords. Erland glanced at him for a moment, but quickly withdrew his eyes. Then he too turned crimson. A strangely delicate and girlish blush spread over his tan skin. He sat motionless, embarrassed and confused, with his little childish mouth open. Simon stood up abruptly and went over to the bed. You'll want to take the outside edge, I presume. He tried to speak calmly and with nonchalance, but his voice quavered.
No, I'll let you decide, said Erland numbly.
He got to his feet.
The fire?
He asked, flustered.
Should I cover the ashes?
He began raking the hearth. Finish that and then come to bed, said Simon in the same tone. His heart was pounding so hard that he could barely talk. In the dark, Erlan, soundless as a shadow, slipped under the covers on the outer edge of the bed and lay down, as quiet as a forest creature. Simon thought he would suffocate from having the other man in his bed. Chapter 6 Every year during Easter week, Simon Andersen held an ale feast for the people of the village. They came to Formo on the third day after Mass and stayed until Thursday. Kristin had never particularly enjoyed these banquets with their bantering and pleasantry. Both Simon and Romborg seemed to think that the more commotion and noise there was, the better. Simon always invited his guests to bring along their children, their servants, and the children of their servants, as many as could be spared from home. On the first day, everything proceeded in a quiet and orderly manner. Only the gentry and the elders would converse, while the youth listened and ate and drank, and the little children kept mostly to a different building. But on the second day, from early in the morning on, the host would urge the lively young people and the children to drink and make merry, and before long the teasing would grow so wild and unrestrained that the women and maidens would slip away to the corners and stand there in clusters, giggling and ready to flee. But many of the more high-standing wives would seek out Romborg's women's house, which was already occupied by the mothers who had rescued the youngest children from the tumult of the main building. One game that was a favorite among the men was pretending to hold a ting. They would read summons documents, present grievances, proclaim new laws and modify old ones, but they always twisted the words around and said them backward. Audun Torbjörnsson could recite King Håkon's letter to the merchants of Björgvin. What they could charge for men's hose and for leather soles on a woman's shoes, about the men who made swords and big and small shields. But he would mix up the words until they were all jumbled and sheer babble. This game always ended with the men not having any idea what they were saying. Kristin remembered from her childhood that her father would never allow the jesting to turn to ridicule of anything related to the church or divine services. But otherwise, Lavrans thought it great fun when he and his guests would compete by jumping up on the tables and benches while they merrily shouted all manner of coarse and unseemly nonsense. Simon was usually most fond of games in which a man was blindfolded and had to search through the ashes for a knife, or two people had to bob for pieces of gingerbread in a big bowl of ale. The other guests would try to make them laugh, and the ale would spray all around. Or they were supposed to use their teeth to dig a ring out of a flour bin. The hall would soon take on the look of a pigsty. But this year they had such surprisingly glorious spring weather for Easter. On Wednesday, by early morning, it was already sunny and warm, and right after breakfast, everyone went out to the courtyard. Instead of making a noisy ruckus, the young people played with balls, or shot at targets, or had tugs of war with a rope. Later they played the stag game or the woodpile dance. And afterward they persuaded Germund of Kruka to sing and play his harp. Soon everyone, both young and old, had joined the dance. Snow still covered the fields, but the alder trees were brown with buds, and the sun shone warm and lovely on all the bare slopes. When the guests came outside after supper, there were birds singing everywhere. Then they made a bonfire in the field beyond the smithy, and they sang and danced until late into the night. The next morning, everyone stayed in bed a long time and left the banquet manor much later than usual. The guests from Urengard were normally the last to depart, but this time Simon persuaded Erland and Kristen to stay until the following day. Those from Kruka were to stay at Formo until the end of the week. Simon had accompanied the last of his guests up to the main road. The evening sun was shining so beautifully on his estate, spread out over the hillside. He was warm and in high spirits from the drinking and noise of the feast. He walked back between the fences, homeward to the calm and pleasant goodwill that prevails when a small circle of close kin remains after a great banquet. He felt so light of heart and happier than he had been for a long time. Down in the field near the smithy, they had lit another bonfire. Erland's sons, Sigrid's older children, Jon Dolk's sons, and his own daughters. Simon leaned over the fence for a moment to watch. Ulvild's scarlet feast day gown gleamed and rippled in the sun. She ran back and forth, dragging branches over to the fire, and suddenly she was stretched out full length on the ground. Her father shouted merrily, but the children didn't hear him. In the courtyard, two serving maids were tending to the smallest of the children. They were sitting against the wall of the women's house, basking in the sun. Above their heads, the evening light gleamed like molten gold on the small glass window pane. Simon picked up little Inga Germund's daughter, tossed her high in the air, and then held her in his arms. "Can you sing for your uncle today, pretty Inga?" Then her brother and Andres both fell upon Simon, wanting to be tossed up in the air, too. Whistling, he climbed the stairs to the great hall in the loft. The sun was shining into the room so splendidly. They had let the door stand open. A wondrous calm reigned over everyone. At the end of the table, Erland and Germund were bent over the harp, on which they were putting new strings. They had the mead horn standing near them on the table. Sigrid was in bed, nursing her youngest son. Kristen and Romborg were sitting with her, and a silver mug stood on a footstool between the sisters. Simon filled his own gilded goblet to the brim with wine, went over to the bed, and drank a toast to Sigrid. "I see that all have quenched their thirst, except you, my sister." Laughing, she propped herself up on her elbow and accepted the goblet. The infant began howling crossly at being disturbed. Simon sat down on the bench, still whistling softly, and listened with half an ear to what the others were saying. Sigrid and Kristen were talking about their children. Romborg was silent, fiddling with a windmill that belonged to Andres. The men at the table were strumming the harp, trying it out. Germund picked out a melody on the harp and sang along. They both had such charming voices. After a while, Simon went out to the gallery, leaned against the carved post, and gazed out. From the cowshed came the eternally hungry lowing. If this weather held on for a time, perhaps the spring shortages wouldn't last as long this year. Kristen was approaching. He didn't have to turn around. He recognized her light step. She stepped forward and stood at his side in the evening sun. So fair and graceful. She had never seemed to him more beautiful. And all of a sudden, he felt as if he had somehow been lifted up and were swimming in the light. He let out a long breath. Suddenly, he thought, it was simply good to be alive. A rich and golden bliss washed over him. She was his own sweet love. All the troubled and bitter thoughts he had had seemed nothing more than half-forgotten foolishness. "My poor love, if only I could comfort you. If only you could be happy again. I would gladly give up my life if it would help you." Oh yes, he could see that her lovely face looked older and more careworn. She had an abundance of fine little wrinkles under her eyes,
and her skin had lost its delicate hue. It had become coarser and tan from the sun, but she was pale under the tan. And yet to him, she would surely always be just as beautiful. Her big gray eyes, her fine, calm mouth, her round little chin, and her steady, subdued demeanor were the fairest he knew on earth. It was a pleasure to see her once again dressed in a manner befitting a high-born woman. The thin little silk wimple covered only half of her golden brown tresses. Her braids had been pinned up so they peeked out in front of her ears. There were streaks of gray in her hair now, but that didn't matter. And she was wearing a magnificent blue surcoat made of velvet and trimmed with marten fur. The bodice was cut so low and the sleeve holes so deep that the garment clung to her breast and shoulders like the narrow straps of a bridle. It looked so lovely. Underneath there was a glimpse of something sand yellow, a gown that fit snugly to her body, all the way up to her throat and down to her wrists. It was held closed with dozens of tiny gilded buttons, which touched him so deeply. God forgive him. All those little golden buttons gave him as much joy as the sight of a flock of angels. He stood there and felt the strong, steady beat of his own heart. Something had fallen away from him. Yes, like chains. Vile, hateful dreams. They were just phantoms of the night. Now he could see the love he felt for her in the light of day, in full sunlight. "You're looking at me so strangely, Simon. Why are you smiling like that?" The man gave a quiet, merry laugh but did not reply. Before them stretched the valley, filled with the golden warmth of the evening sun. Flocks of birds warbled and chirped metallically from the edge of the woods. Then the full, clear voice of the song thrush rang out from somewhere inside the forest. And here she stood, warmed by the sun, radiant in her brilliant finery, having emerged from the dark, cold house and the rough, heavy clothing that smelled of sweat and toil. "My Kristen, it's good to see you this way again." He took her hand, which lay before him on the railing of the gallery, and lifted it to his face. "The ring you're wearing is so lovely." He turned the gold ring on her finger and then put her hand back down. It was reddish and rough now, and he didn't know how he could ever make amends to it. So fair it had once been, her big, slender hand. "There's Arnjord and Gaute," said Kristen. "The two of them are quarreling again." Their voices could be heard from underneath the loft gallery, shrill and angry. Now the maiden began shouting furiously,
"Go ahead and remind me of that. It seems to me a greater honor to be called my father's bastard daughter than to be the lawful son of yours."
Kristen spun on her heel and ran down the stairs. Simon followed and heard the sound of two or three slaps. She was standing under the gallery, clutching her son by the shoulder. The two children had their eyes downcast. They were red-faced, silent, and defiant.
"I see you know how to behave as a guest. You do us such honor, your father and me."
Gauta stared at the ground. In a low, angry voice, he said to his mother,
"She said something. I don't want to repeat it."
Simon put his hand under his daughter's chin and tilted her face up. Arnjord turned even brighter red, and her eyes blinked under her father's gaze.
"Yes," she said, pulling away from him. "I reminded Gauta that his father was a condemned villain and traitor. But before that he called you. He said that you, father, were the traitor, and that it was thanks to Erland that you were now sitting here, safe and rich, on your own manor."
"I thought you were a grown-up maiden by now. Are you going to let childish chatter provoke you so that you forget both your manners and honor among kin?"
Angrily he pushed the girl away, turned toward Gauta, and asked calmly,
"What do you mean, Gauta, my friend, that I betrayed your father? I've noticed before that you're cross with me. Now tell me, what do you mean?"
"You know what I mean."
Simon shook his head. Then the boy shouted, his eyes flashing with bitterness,
"The letter they tortured my father on the rack for, trying to make him say who had put their seal on it. I saw that letter myself. I was the one who took it and burned it."
"Keep silent."
Erlan broke in among them. His face was deathly white, all the way to his lips. His eyes blazed.
No, Erlan. It's better that we clear up this matter now. Was my name mentioned in the letter? Keep silent.
Furiously, Erlan seized Gauta by the shoulder and chest.
I trusted you. You, my son. It would serve you right if I killed you now.
Kristen sprang forward, as did Simon. The boy tore himself loose and took refuge with his mother. Beside himself with rage, he screamed furiously as he hid behind Kristen's arm.
I picked it up and looked at the seals before I burned it, father. I thought the day might come when I could serve you by doing so. May God curse you.
A brief, dry sob racked Erlan's body. Simon, too, had turned pale and then dark red in the face, out of shame for his brother-in-law. He didn't dare look in Erlan's direction. He thought he would suffocate from the other's humiliation. Kristen stood as if bewitched, still holding her arms protectively around her son. But one thought followed another in rapid succession. Erlan had had Simon's private seal in his possession for a short time during that spring. The brothers-in-law had jointly sold Lavran's dock warehouse at Vier to the cloister on Holm. Erlan had mentioned that this was probably unlawful, but surely no one would question it. He had shown her the seal and said that Simon should have had a finer one carved. All three brothers had acquired a copy of their father's seal, only the inscriptions were different. But Geird's was much more finely etched, said Erlan. Geird Dara. Erlan had brought her greetings from him after both of his last journeys to the south. She remembered being surprised that Erlan had visited Geird at Difrin. They had met only once, at Romborg's wedding. Ulf Saxason was Geird Dara's brother-in-law. Ulf had been part of the plot.
You were mistaken, Gauta, said Simon in a low, firm voice.
Simon!
Unawares, Kristen gripped her husband's hand.
Keep in mind, there are other men than yourself who bear that emblem on their seal.
Silence! Will you too?
Erlan tore himself away from his wife with a tormented wail and raced across the courtyard toward the stable. Simon set off after him.
Erlan? Was it my brother? Send for the boys. Follow me home,
Erlan shouted back to his wife. Simon caught up with him in the stable doorway and grabbed him by the arm.
Erlan? Was it Geird?
Erlan didn't reply. He tried to wrench his arm away. His face looked oddly stubborn and deathly pale.
Erlan, answer me. Did my brother join you in that plan? Perhaps you too would like to test your sword against mine,
Erlan snarled, and Simon could feel the other man's body trembling as they struggled.
You know I wouldn't.
Simon let go and sank back against the doorframe. Erlan, in the name of Christ, who suffered death for our sakes, tell me if it's true. Erlan let Sultan out, and Simon had to step aside from the doorway. An attentive servant brought his saddle and bridle. Simon took them and sent the man away. Then Erlan took them from Simon.
Erlan, surely you can tell me now. You can tell me?
He didn't know why he was begging as if for his very life.
Erlan, answer me. On the wounds of Christ, I beseech you. Tell me, man. You can keep on thinking what you thought before, said Erlan in a low and cutting voice.
Erlan, I didn't think anything.
I know what you thought.
Erlan swung himself into the saddle. Simon grabbed the harness. The horse shifted and pranced uneasily.
Let go, or I'll run you down, said Erlan. Then I'll ask Geird.
I'll ride south tomorrow.
By God, Erlan, you have to tell me.
Yes, I'm sure he will give you an answer, said Erlan scornfully, spurring the stallion so that Simon had to leap aside. Then Erlan galloped off from the estate. Halfway up the courtyard, Simon met Kristen. She was wearing her cloak. Gauta walked at her side, carrying their clothing sack. Romborg followed her sister. The boy glanced up for a moment, frightened and confused. Then he withdrew his gaze, but Kristen fixed her big eyes directly on Simon's face. They were dark with sorrow and anger. Could you truly believe that of Erlon? That he would betray you in such a manner?
I didn't believe anything, said Simon vehemently. I thought the boy was just babbling nonsense and foolishness.
No, Simon. I don't want you to come with me, said Kristen quietly.
He saw that she was unspeakably offended and grieved. That evening, when Simon was alone with his wife in the main house, as they undressed and their daughters were already asleep in the other bed, Romborg suddenly asked,
Didn't you know anything about this, Simon?
No. Did you? He asked tensely.
Romborg came over and stood in the glow of the candle standing on the table. She was half undressed, in her shift and laced bodice. Her hair fell in loose curls around her face. I don't know, but I had a feeling. Helga was so strange. Her features twisted into an odd sort of smile, and she looked as if she were freezing. She talked about how new times would be coming to Norway. The great chieftains would acquire the same rights here as in other lands. Romborg gave a crooked, almost contorted smile. They would be called knights and barons again. Later, when I saw that you took up their affairs with such zeal, and you were away from home almost a whole year, and didn't even feel that you could come north to be with me at Ringheim when I was staying on a stranger's estate, about to give birth to your child, I thought perhaps you knew that it concerned others than Erlon.
Ha! Knights and barons! Simon gave an angry laugh.
Then it was merely for Kristen's sake that you did it?
He saw that her face was pale, as if from frostbite. It was impossible to pretend that he didn't understand what she meant. Out of spite and despair, he exclaimed, Yes. Then he thought that she must have gone mad, and he was mad too. Erland was mad. They had all lost their wits that day. But now there had to be an end to it. I did it for your sister's sake, yes, he said soberly. And for the sake of the children who had no other man closer in family or kinship to protect them. And for Erland's sake, since we should be as loyal to each other as brothers. So don't start behaving foolishly, for I've seen more than enough of that here on the estate today, he bellowed, and flung the shoe he had just taken off against the wall.
Romborg went over and picked it up. She looked at the timber it had struck. It's shameful that Torberg didn't think of it herself, to wash off the soot in here before the feast. I forgot to mention it to her.
She wiped off the shoe. It was Simon's best, with a long toe and red heel. She picked up its mate and put both of them into his clothes chest. But Simon noticed that her hands were shaking badly as she did so. Then he went over and took her in his arms. She twined her thin arms around her husband as she trembled with stifled sobs and whispered to him that she was so tired. 7 days later, Simon and his servant rode through Kvam, heading north. They fought their way through a blizzard of great wet snowflakes. At midday, they arrived at the small farm on the public road where there was an alehouse. The proprietress came out and invited Simon to come into their home. Only commoners were shown into the tavern. She shook out his outer garment and hung it up to dry on the wall peg near the hearth as she talked. Such awful weather, hard on the horses, and he must have had to ride the whole way around. It wasn't possible to go across Lake Mjøsa now, was it? Oh yes, if a man was sick enough of his life. The woman and her children standing nearby all laughed agreeably. The older ones went about their chores, bringing in wood and ale, while the younger ones huddled together near the door. They usually received a few penje from Simon, the master of Formo, whenever he stayed there, and if he was bringing home treats for his own children from Hamar, he would often give them a tidbit too. But today he didn't seem to notice them. He sat on the bench, leaning forward, with his hands hanging over his knees, staring into the hearth fire,
and replied with a word or two to the woman's incessant chatter. Then she mentioned that Erlan Nikolausen happened to be at Granheim. It was the day on which the ancestral owners were to place the first payment in the hands of the former owners. Should she send one of the children over to his brother-in-law with a message so that they could ride home together? No, said Simon. She could give him a little food, and then he would lie down and sleep for a while. He would see Erland in good time. What he had to say, he wanted to say in front of Gauta. But he would prefer not to speak of the matter more than once. His servant, Sigurd, had sought refuge in the cookhouse while the woman prepared the food. Yes, it had been a wearisome journey, and his master had been like an angry bull almost the whole way. Normally, Simon Andresen liked to hear whatever news from his home district his servants could glean while they were at Diefrin. He usually had one or more people from Raumarike in his service. Folks would come to him to ask for work whenever he was home, for he was known as a well-liked and generous man who was merry and not high-handed with his servants. But on this journey, about the only answer that he, Sigurd, had received from his master was, "Keep silent." He had apparently had a great quarrel with his brothers. He hadn't even stayed the night at Diefrin. They had taken lodgings on a tenant farm farther out in the countryside. Sir Geird, yes, for he could tell her that the king had made his master's brother a knight at Christmas time. Well, Sir Geird had come out to the courtyard and warmly entreated Simon to stay. But Simon had given his brother a curt reply. And they had roared and bellowed and shouted, all those gentlemen up in the high loft. Sir Ulf Saxison and Goodman Andresen had been on the estate as well, so that everyone was terribly frightened. God only knew what it was that had made them foes. Simon came past the cookhouse, paused for a moment, and peered inside. Sigurd announced quickly that he would get an awl and a strap to make proper repairs to the harness that had been torn in the morning.
"Do they have those kinds of things in the cookhouse on this farm?" Simon flung over his shoulder as he left.
Sigurd shook his head and nodded to the woman when Simon had disappeared from sight. Simon pushed his plate aside but stayed seated. He was so tired that he could hardly even get up. At last he got to his feet and threw himself onto the bed, still wearing his boots and spurs, but then thought better of it. It was a good, clean bed for the house of a commoner. He sat up and pulled off his boots. Stiff and worn out as he was, surely he would be able to sleep now. He was soaked through and freezing, but his face burned after the long ride in the storm. He crawled under the coverlet, twisting and turning the pillows. They smelled so strangely of fish. Then he stretched out, half reclining, propped up on one elbow. His thoughts began circling again. He had been thinking and thinking these past few days, the way an animal plods around a tether. Even if Erling Vidkunsson had known that the welfare of Geird and Gudmundare might also be at stake if Erlan Nikolausen had been broken and talked, well, that didn't make it any worse that Simon had seized upon all means to win the help of the Bjarker knight. Quite the opposite. Surely a man was obligated to stand by his own brothers, even to the death if need be. But he still wished that he knew whether Erling had known about it. Simon weighed the matter for and against. Erling couldn't possibly have been entirely ignorant that a rebellion was brewing. But what exactly had he known? Geird and Ulf, at any rate, didn't seem to know whether the man was aware of their complicity. But Simon remembered that Erling had mentioned the Hoftersons and had advised him to seek their help, for it was most likely their friends who would need to be afraid. The Hoftersons were cousins of Ulf Saxison and Helga. The nose is right next to the eyes. But even if Erling Vidkunsson believed that he was also thinking of his own brothers, surely that didn't make what he had done any worse. And Erling might have realized that he knew nothing about his brother's peril. Besides, he had said himself that He remembered he had told Stieg that he didn't think they could torture Erlund into talking. They might still have reason to fear Erlund's tongue. He had kept silent through the torture and imprisonment, but he was the kind of man who might let it slip out afterward through some chance remark. It would be just like him. And yet, Simon thought this was the one thing he could be certain that Erlund would never do. He was as silent as a rock every time the conversation touched on the matter, precisely because he was afraid of being lured into some slip of the tongue. Simon understood that Erlund had a fierce, almost childish terror of breaching a promise. Childish because the fact that he had given away the whole plan to his lover clearly did not seem to Erlund to have tarnished his honor in any significant way. He apparently thought that such could happen to the best of men. As long as he himself held his tongue, he considered his shield unblemished and his promise unbroken. And Simon had noticed that Erlund was sensitive about his honor, as far as his own understanding of honor and reputation went. He had nearly lost his wits from desperation and anger at the mere thought that any of his fellow conspirators might be exposed. Even now, so much later, and in such a manner that it couldn't possibly make any difference to the men whom he had protected with his life, as well as with his honor and his property. All because of a child talking to the closest kinsman of these men. Erlund wanted to handle it in such a way that if things went wrong, he would be the one to pay the price for all of them. That's what he had vowed on the crucifix to every man who had joined him in the plot. But to think that grown-up, sensible men would put their faith in such an oath, when it was not entirely within Erlund's control. Now that Simon had learned everything about the plan, he thought it was the greatest foolishness he had ever heard. Erlund had been willing to let his body be torn apart, limb from limb, in order to keep his sworn oath. All the while, the secret lay in the hands of a 10-year-old boy. Erlund himself had seen to that. And it was evidently no thanks to him that Suniva Olav's daughter didn't know more than she did. Could anyone ever make sense of such a man? If, for a moment, he had believed. Well, what Erlund and his wife thought he had believed. God only knew how close to the truth such a thought was when Gauta started talking about seeing his seal on the treasonous letter. The two of them might remember that he knew a few things about Erlund Nikolausen so that he, more than most other men, had little reason to believe the best of that gentleman. But they had probably forgotten long ago how he had once come upon them and witnessed the depths of their shamelessness. So there was little reason for him to lie here, berating himself like a dog because he had wrongly accused Erlund in his mind. God knew it was not because he wanted to think ill of his brother-in-law. It only made him unhappy to have such thoughts. He was fully aware that it was a wildly foolish notion. He would have realized at once, even without Kristen's words, that things couldn't have happened that way. As quickly as the suspicion occurred to him that Erlund might have misused his seal, he had dismissed it. No, Erlund couldn't possibly have done that. Erlund had never in his life committed a dishonorable act that had been thought out in advance or with some specific purpose in mind. Simon tossed and turned in bed, moaning. They had made him half mad with all this madness. He felt so tormented when he thought about how Gauta had gone around for years, believing this of him. But it was unreasonable for him to take it so hard. Even though he was fond of the boy, fond of all of Kristen's sons, they were still hardly more than children. Did he need to be so concerned about how they might judge him? To think he could be so furious with rage when he thought about the men who had placed their hands on the hilt of Erlon's sword and sworn to follow their chieftain. If they were such sheep to allow themselves to be dazzled by Erlon's persuasive and bold manner, and to believe that he was a suitable chieftain, then it was only to be expected that they would behave like frightened sheep when the whole venture went awry. And yet he felt dazed when he thought about what he had learned at Dieferin, that so many men had dared entrust the peace of the land and their own welfare into Erlund's hands. Even Haftor Olafsson and Borgar Tronsson,
but not one of them had the courage to step forward and demand of the king that Erlan should be granted an honorable reconciliation and a reprieve for his ancestral estates. There were so many of them that if they had joined forces, it could easily have been accomplished. Apparently, there was less wisdom and courage among the noblemen of Norway than he had thought. Simon was also angry because he had been entirely kept out of these plans. Not that they would have been able to enlist him in such a foolhardy enterprise, but that both Erland and Geird had gone behind his back and concealed everything. Surely he was just as good a nobleman as any of the others, and not without some influence in the regions where people knew him. In some ways, he agreed with Geird. Considering the manner in which Erland had squandered his position as chieftain, the man couldn't reasonably demand that his fellow conspirators should step forward and declare their allegiance with him. Simon knew that if he had found Geird alone, he would not have ended up parting with his brothers in such a fashion. But there sat that night, Sir Ulf, stretching out his long legs in front of him and talking about Erland's lack of sense, after it was all over. And then Gudmund spoke up. In the past, neither Geird nor Simon had let their younger brother take a position against them. But ever since he had married the priest's paramour, who then became his own paramour, the boy had grown so swaggering and cocky and independent. Simon had sat there glaring fiercely at Gudmund. He spoke so arrogantly, and his round red face looked so much like a child's backside that Simon's hands itched to give it a swat. In the end, he hardly knew what he was saying to the three men. And now he had broken with his brothers. He felt as if he would bleed to death when he thought about it, as if bonds of flesh and blood had been severed. He was the poorer for it. Bare is the brotherless back. But however things now stood, in the midst of the heated exchange of words, he had suddenly realized, he didn't know exactly why, that Geird's closed and stony demeanor wasn't solely due to the fact that he was hard-pressed to find any peace at home. In a flash, Simon saw that Geird still loved Helga. That was what made him so strangely fettered and powerless. And in some secretive, incomprehensible way, this aroused his fury over, well, over life itself. Simon hid his face in his hands. Yes, in that sense they had been good, obedient sons. It had been easy for Geird and him to feel love for the brides whom his father announced he had chosen for them. The old man had made a long, splendid speech to them one evening, and afterward they had both sat there feeling abashed. About marriage and friendship and faithfulness between honorable noble spouses, in the end, their father even mentioned prayers of intercession and masses. It was too bad their father hadn't given them advice on how to forget as well. When the friendship was broken, and the honor dead, and the faithfulness a sin, and a secret, disgraceful torment, and there was nothing left of the bond but the bleeding wound that would never heal. After Erland was released, an odd feeling of calm came over Simon, if only because a man can't continue to endure the kind of pain he had suffered during that time in Oslo. Either something happens, or it gets better of its own accord. Simon had not been pleased when Kristin moved to Jørungard with her husband and all their children, so that he had to see them more often and keep up their friendship and kinship. But he consoled himself that it would have been much worse if he had been forced to live with her in a fashion that is unbearable for a man. To live with a woman he loves when she is not his wife or his kinswoman by blood. He chose to ignore what had occurred between his brother-in-law and himself on that evening, when they celebrated Erland's release from the tower. Erland had probably understood only half of it, and surely hadn't given it much thought. Erland had such a rare talent for forgetting. And Simon had his own estate, a wife whom he loved, and his children. He had found some semblance of peace with himself. It was not his fault that he loved his wife's sister. She had once been his betrothed, and he was not the one who had broken his promise. back when he had set his heart on Kristin Lavran's daughter. It had simply been his duty to do so, because he thought she was intended to be his wife. The fact that he married her sister. That was Romborg's doing, and her father's. Lavran's, as wise a man as he was, hadn't thought to ask whether Simon had forgotten. But he knew that he couldn't have stood to be asked that question by Lavran's. Simon wasn't good at forgetting. He was not to blame for that. And he had never spoken a single word that he ought to have withheld. But he couldn't help it if the devil plagued him with impulses and dreams that violated the bonds of blood. He had never willingly indulged in sinful thoughts of love. And he had always behaved like a loyal brother toward her and her kin. Of that he was certain. At last he had managed to be tolerably content with his lot. But only as long as he knew that he was the one who had served those two, Kristin and the man she had chosen in his stead. They had always been in need of his support. Now this had changed. Kristin had risked her life and soul to save the life of his son. It felt as if all the old wounds had opened up ever since he allowed that to happen. Later, he became indebted to Erland for his own life. And then, in return, he had affronted the man. Not intentionally, and only in his thoughts, but still. E dimite nobis debita nostra. Sicut e nos dimittibus debitoribus nostris. It was strange that the Lord hadn't also taught them to pray, Sicut e nos dimittibus creditoribus nostris. He didn't know whether this was proper Latin. He had never been particularly good at the language. But he knew that in some way he had always been able to forgive his debtors. It seemed much harder to forgive anyone who had bound a debt around his neck. But now they were even, he and those two. He felt all the old resentments, which he had trampled underfoot for years, rip open and come to life. He could no longer shove Erland aside in his thoughts as a foolish chatterer who couldn't see or learn or remember or ponder anything at all. Now the other man weighed on his mind precisely because no one knew what Erland saw or thought or remembered. He was completely unfathomable. Many a man is given what was intended for another, but no one is given another man's fate. How truly spoken. Simon had loved his young betrothed. If he had won her, he would certainly have been a contented man. Surely they would have lived well together. And she would have continued to be as she was when they first met, gentle and seemly, intelligent enough that a man would gladly seek her counsel, even on important matters. A bit headstrong about petty things, but otherwise amenable, accustomed as she was to accepting from her father's hands guidance and support and protection. But then that man had seized hold of her, a man incapable of restraining himself, who had never offered protection to anything. He had ravaged her sweet innocence, broken her proud calm, destroyed her womanly soul, and forced her to stretch and strain to the utmost every faculty she possessed. She had to defend her lover, the way a tiny bird protects its nest with a trembling body and shrill voice when anyone comes too close. It had seemed to Simon that her lovely, slender body was created to be lifted up and fervently shielded by a man's arms. He had seen it tense with wild stubbornness, as her heart pounded with courage and fear and the will to fight, and she battled for her husband and children, the way even a dove can turn fierce and fearless if she has young ones. If he had been her husband, if she had lived with his honorable goodwill for 15 winters, he was certain that she would have stood up to defend him too if he had landed in misfortune. With shrewdness and courage, she would have stood by his side. But he would never have seen that stony face she turned toward him on the evening in Oslo, when she told him that she had been over to take a look around in that house. He would never have heard her scream his own name in such desperate need and distress. And it was not the honorable and just love of his youth that had answered in his heart.
the ardor that rose up and cried out toward her wild spirit. He would never have known that such feeling could reside in his own heart if things had happened between them as their fathers had intended. Her expression, as she walked past him and went out into the night to find help for